what people I think have been longing for is to be able to like admit what they can tell is just not right, you know, and it feels like a relief, I think, for people to be able to sort of talk in a normal way. And one of the things that the climate movement at large has really got wrong in a catastrophic, at a very catastrophic scale, I think, is to lean solely into science and materialism and rationality, which is like, firstly, like not how people make decisions, because human beings are actually made up of a whole lot of humanity, and that is not pure rationalism. That's just bollocks. But also, you know, because in doing so, you sort of commit yourself to the territory of scientific philosophy. And that is a problem, because the basis of science is that everything's being questioned all the time. And it's left it as a field of debate, it's left it wide open to the opposition to just constantly, for like more than a generation, use the same argument and win, because they can say, yeah, but it's not certain, is it? See what I mean? Like, in a really simplistic way, the scientific basis for discussion is, we'll carry on questioning this because it's always questionable, and it can always be, our knowledge can always be improved. You know, and with that in mind, like a very simplistic way to explain why this is a fucking problem when you're facing an existential risk is that if you need to be certain, which my friend calls it the certainty fetish, it is a problem that people want certainty and they can't have it. But anyway, you know, if you want to be certain that there's a chance of human extinction, you'll never ever be certain until it happens. So if you need to be certain, you can't act against it until it happens, and then you can't act against it. So, you know, to that's a massive oversimplification, but it illustrates the point, right? Which is, we've been using the wrong intellectual apparatus to discuss this problem, which has not just left us vulnerable to repeated like takedowns by the PR people who work for the opposition, who I used to think were very clever, but actually they're not. They haven't needed to be terribly clever. They've just needed to see one weak point, and they've, you know, our side have allowed them to exploit that for far too long, far too effectively, in my opinion. It's like not okay, but also like not hauling this debate into the territory of a risk analysis. Because if you go to like a risk analyst and say, can you build a bridge that's got a 50% chance of collapsing? They'll say no. So can you release a medicine that has a 45% chance of causing everybody who takes it to have a stroke? No, you can't do that. So you look at any other part of our lives, you would never do what we've collectively done with climate.
Welcome to UFO, a podcast where artists, musicians, and Web3 builders talk about the future, a place for revolutionary ideas. I'm your host, Nick Hollins, and on today's show, Claire Farrell, a co-founding member of Extinction Rebellion. She's an activist, artist, designer, communicator, and organizer. Over the past months in the UK, Extinction Rebellion has been building up to the big one. 4 days of action from April 21st to the 24th around Westminster and the Houses of Parliament in London, where people from all groups and movements, not just XR, would gather throughout Westminster and at the Houses of Parliament. More than 200 organisations were looping into support, including Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. Accessible and welcoming, a peaceful, non-violent action demanding net zero emissions by 2025 for citizens' assemblies and reparatory justice. As it happens, this protest coincided with the London Marathon on April 23, an iconic cultural sporting event for the city, or so I have been learning just recently. For the first time, it was to be a mass demonstration which teamed up with other charities and environmental activist groups in a broad coalition. The UK press cooked it up to be some kind of crisis, as though the marathon and British society was itself under threat. If you've ever seen the Adam McKay movie Don't Look Up with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, in which an asteroid is found to be on a direct collision course with Earth, and the protagonists go on national TV news in America to try and raise the alarm, only to be met by the banal absurdity of how mainstream news works. Why are you getting so emotional about this? You're so unlikable. We're just here to do a quick TV appearance and take a few swipes at you before we'll cut back to Facebook-level content in between advertisements. Well, Claire Farrell has that role in real life as part of Extinction Rebellion. She's the one who goes on TV to speak on behalf of this decentralized organization and movement, especially when the news program has potential to be a bit combative or antagonistic. A surreal experience to find yourself. It's not your everyday, and she's quite good at it. In this episode, we talk about Claire's origins in fashion and design and creative activism, up to being part of the originating group of Extinction Rebellion in 2018, along with Charlie Waterhouse, who was our very first guest on UFO way back in 2022. We discuss the demands of Extinction Rebellion for net zero carbon emissions by 2025, for citizens' assemblies and direct democracy, and reparatory justice for nations and people around the world most impacted by the climate crisis. We also talk about the non-functional political process, expanding police powers in the UK and Australia, and punitive jail sentences and fines being introduced to discourage peaceful protest and assembly. About the failings of mainstream media to even pretend they're here to faithfully report the news and context of the world we're living in, not just for the climate issue, and what this all means for us and the planet. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsors helping to put UFO on the air. First up, our friends at Xerion. UFO is a podcast that brings together the brightest builders, creators, and founders shaping the cultural side of Web3. And Xerion is the perfect wallet for these active citizens. Xerion combines every corner of Web3 in a simple and intuitive app for self-custodial humans. Discover the hottest NFT collections, track your DeFi rewards, and vote in DAOs across 10 plus chains. Come along and check out their app on mobile. You can get started at Xerion.io. That's Xerion.io. Lens Protocol is the open source tech stack for building decentralized social media applications. It's a new era for social media in Web3. Lens isn't a social media app. It's a protocol to let Web3 social apps thrive, a permissionless and transparent social graph that is owned by the user. With Lens, your followers go with you to whatever application you want to use, and instead of being trapped inside the walled garden of an algorithm, Lens lets you choose the way you want to experience your social media. To explore the future of Web3 social, visit lens.xyz. UFO is available on all Lens apps at ufoclub.lens. Yup is the best of Web3 all-in-one feed, aggregating the best content of Lens, Farcaster, Mirror, NFTs, and Crypto Twitter, and now Blue Sky. Search across platforms, customize your feed, and show off your NFTs and PoApps on your profile. Everyone in the community is invited to register for the Yup mobile beta via their website. The best of Web3 in one feed, visit yup.io. To explore links for Claire Farrell, Extinction Rebellion, and projects we talk about in this episode, check out the show notes at ufo.mirror.xyz. You can find Claire on Twitter at Claire Totty, that's C-L-A-R-E-T-O-T-T-Y, and their website at extinctionrebellion.uk. Let's jump in, starting with Claire's earlier experiences leading up to being part of the founding movement at XR.
I was previously doing fashion, and I studied fashion at university, having been really very interested when I was at school in loads of stuff, but definitely like a keen interest in science. So I studied chemistry when I was 16, 17, 18, and had as I guess an unusual interest in it for somebody who was then became a an art school student and a fashion student. And I would say we had a conversation the other day, me and some friends, about like why could we say in three words why we're doing what we're doing? Or, you know, five words or something. Very, very tight. Like what made you do this? And my answer, one of my main answers is that when I was a kid, I used to think if we bury loads of shit in the ground that never disappears, then one day the whole world will be made of rubbish. And when you're a kid and you think things like that, and you look at the state of the world and what's going on, you think, well, there just must be some shit that I don't understand because I'm a kid. And then you grow up and realize that you were right, you know, and like, you know, a 6-year-old can see what's going on with the world perfectly well, actually. And so I guess I sort of carried those feelings. And obviously the 80s was like a big time for Greenpeace and litter picking and Save the Whale campaigns, and it was, you know, there was a sort of popular green movement at that time. But I, you know, when I went to fashion school, I guess I sort of, you know, a part of me just felt like, wow, this is actually like quite pointless. And so I wrote a dissertation about how fashion and textiles was affecting the environment and how you might change that. And it was quite sort of fact-based rather than most people's dissertations at art school are much more humanities orientated in the sort of like way that they work, and the way that people think through stuff. And so when I left, I went and worked commercially in the fashion sector. I did that for some time, but then ended up working with a friend of a friend who had started an upcycled women's wear label. So I did a lot of work in reclaimed materials. What I would write on my CV is like pioneering upcycling manufacturing techniques and developing processes and approaches that would facilitate the mass production of garments that are standardizable, even though they're made out of post-consumer textile waste and post-industrial waste. All of that stuff, by the way, I think would sell really well now. But it was quite hard to sell it in 2009, 10. And you know, I've started a couple of small businesses. I sort of ran that one. I started another small business of my own doing technical women's cycle wear, which was trying to sort of take my design work from being a fashion designer into being a kind of product designer. So producing garments that facilitate a sustainable and healthy lifestyle, rather than, you know, churning out seasonal stuff that changes and changes and changes. It was like a slow and like modular approach to design, which was quite a switch up for me. But in all honesty, you know, I'm no good capitalist, put it that way. And I'm appallingly bad at selling things. So being a one-woman business wasn't very good. And I started doing this sort of pointed direct action in about 2017. And then we launched XR in 2018. So I had a background in creative activism of different types, but nothing like what we've been doing now.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you came from the kind of upcycling and sustainability movement from within fashion, which is, you know, an astronomically kind of polluting industry or wasteful industry, as we know, in terms of materials and supply chains and all that stuff. I find it interesting that you kind of are emerging from that world, and I imagine within the sort of creative community in the UK or folks that you would have been in, it sounds like there would have been yourself and others that started to transition into this direct action or a, you know, a mindfulness of, you know, the broader context for the environment and stuff like that. And So you're saying these things started to catalyze in 2017, and something kind of remarkable about Extinction Rebellion, because it feels like such a well-known and established brand and movement that it feels like it's been here for longer than being started in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, I always remind people that if you think back to like news stories that have come out in our sort of past recent decades, let's say, you had like the stories that said, we've only got 10 years to deal with climate change. And then 10 years later, you had a story that said, we've only got 10 years to deal with climate change. And then when we launched XR, people were saying, we've got 11 years to deal with climate change. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. You can't, you know, physics and time is, it's not an elastic band. You know, you can't, that can't possibly be correct. And I guess, you know, the parallels, just to go back to like school, for me, there's a big parallel with the CFCs crisis, which when I thought back through my sort of awareness of sustainability issues, particularly from a sort of like science perspective, it is quite clear to me that the CFC crisis, having been like taught that at school in the 90s, that like how that happens, and then being taught that the science was understood in the 1970s, it's an extraordinary gap to be like, yeah, there's these chemicals that are going to make a hole in the sky that will kill people. And you put them in hairspray and spray them into the atmosphere for like 25 or 30 years before you do anything about that, right? And this is the situation with the climate is even more remarkable. You know what I mean? But it's quite a, for my sort of, just go back to my sort of like, child self that goes, what the fuck? It's like, how can people organize society with that knowledge in you know, perfectly like just sitting there for anybody to grasp, and you know, to be governed by people and led by people in business and industry who are either ignorant or willfully ignorant of the best available information and its deadly impact related. You know what I mean? It's just, I find it heartbreaking, actually.
As we kind of refer to this like fairly common sense knowing and experience that, you know, many half reasonable people kind of feel about the world, like, hey, this doesn't really make sense. Or even I can tell, and I'm no scientist, but you know, something about that over there. And I feel like we have the same instinct about, as you say, governance and this like the seemingly overwhelming influence or freedom of sort of corporate interest to kind of do whatever and to dictate how governments move and how policy is made. And we're chatting before, I'm based here in Australia with this kind of political climate, and you're in the UK and stuff like that. But we see a lot of similarities all across the world about how these governments kind of function and make policy. And, you know, the old thing of the revolving door between a corporate boardroom into a government seat and then back out again for a kind of windfall when you hit the corporate world again for all that stuff that you passed while you're in government, you know? So as we can, you know, anyone can kind of observe this happening. And something that I appreciate about the kind of TV appearances and stuff that you make in the press is that you say these common sense things, you know, in these spaces of like, we can all see this, right? Like, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've reached a point of some confidence recently with doing these, you know, media interviews, partly because we don't have to win the argument anymore. You know, I was preparing myself for interviews in like 2018, thinking that I would still meet a climate denier on like a mainstream radio station, or somebody who's trying to minimize what's at stake or whatever. And obviously there are still people knocking around that like chat shit, but mostly I would say, you know, the argument has been won. And you can measure that, right, by like when I don't know, the Murdoch press admits that you need to stop carbon emissions or whatever. It's like we've turned a bit of a corner. But I think also, you know, what people I think have been longing for is to be able to like admit what they can tell is just not right, you know, and it feels like a relief, I think, for people to be able to sort of talk in a normal way. And one of the things that the climate movement at large has really got wrong at a very catastrophic scale, I think, is to lean solely into science and materialism and rationality, which is like, firstly, like not how people make decisions, because human beings are actually made up of a whole lot of humanity, and that is not pure rationalism. That's just bollocks. But also, you know, because in doing so, you sort of commit yourself to the territory of scientific philosophy. And that is a problem, because the basis of science is that everything's being questioned all the time. And it's left it as a field of debate. It's left it wide open to the opposition to just constantly, for like more than a generation, use the same argument and win, because they can say, yeah, but it's not certain, is it? See what I mean? Like in a really simplistic way, the scientific basis for discussion is, we'll carry on questioning this because it's always questionable, and it can always be, our knowledge can always be improved. And, you know, and with that in mind, like a very simplistic way to explain why this is a fucking problem when you're facing an existential risk is that if you need to be certain, which my friend calls it the certainty fetish, it is a problem that people want certainty and they can't have it. But anyway, you know, if you want to be certain that there's a chance of human extinction, you'll never, ever be certain until it happens.
Yeah.
So if you need to be certain, you can't act against it until it happens, and then you can't act against it. So, you know, that's a massive oversimplification, but it illustrates the point, right? Which is, we've been using the wrong intellectual apparatus to discuss this problem, which has not just left us vulnerable to repeated like takedowns by the PR people who work for the opposition, who I used to think were very clever, but actually they're not. They haven't needed to be terribly clever. They've just needed to see one weak point, and they've, you know, our side have allowed them to exploit that for far too long, far too effectively. In my opinion, it's like not okay. But also like not hauling this debate into the territory of a risk analysis. Because if you go to like a risk analyst and say, can you build a bridge that's got a 50% chance of collapsing? They'll say no. So can you release a medicine that has a 45% chance of causing everybody who takes it to have a stroke? No, you can't do that. So you look at any other part of our lives, you would never do what we've collectively done with climate.
I appreciate the point you're making there as far as the very nature of the scientific method and the fact that it's a theory, and then, you know, mimetically being able to put it across to people of like, well, it's not certain, is it? You don't know for sure. It's still a theory. And also, our scientists say this. Everyone can find their own scientists to science out a press release of some kind of thing and say it's still contentious or undecided and stuff like that. And as you say, just kind of spinning the wheels. But in all these other sort of spectrums of kind of discourse, even just sort of with the pandemic and COVID stuff, it was trust science, believe science. That's the science. Don't question it or whatever. Yeah. But then with this thing, it's like, well, science is always up for question. And it's just kind of spinning out.
The other thing is about science, though, is that, you know, it is in evolution, right? Our understanding. And so, and it is going to get worse. Like what we understand now is is much worse than what we understood 10 years ago. It's worse. It's more frightening. It's far more fast. It's far more devastating more quickly. Everything's happening sooner. So, you know, it's a sort of dual problem in a way, because, like, you know, going around saying, follow the science, but then you need to also keep reassessing that science. And the IPCC is a notoriously conservative institutional approach to gathering information, and the sharp end of the risk is much worse than the mainstream discourse would have you believe. So also saying follow the science isn't just like unhelpful, because most people go, well, I don't like science and I don't understand science and I also don't trust scientists, right? Because the way they speak is like psychotic people that don't have any interest in humans or humanity, right?
It's just numbers.
You know, people say these phrases, a livable planet. We need to do X so that we could have a livable future. I mean, you know, I was listening to an expert on the Arctic the other day, and she was going, well, it's an extremely interesting time to be a scientist because loads of things are changing. I thought, you sound like a fucking psycho. Yeah. It's not interesting. It's a massive tragedy. It's fucking devastatingly painful. It's not interesting.
It's like a detective saying, well, there is some kind of mass murderer on the loose, but it's a very interesting time to be a detective. A lot of work to do.
Sorry, no offense, scientists. I don't mean to be mean. as well.
But kind of jumping onto that, like, it's disingenuous to kind of, as you say, like, ask people to go and they're not going to read a scientific report. We don't know what reports. Like, we're, you know, typically not equipped to go and do that stuff. It's unreasonable to think about it like that. But earlier you were saying that, you know, in this moment, it feels like the debate has been won a little bit more in terms of like the public understanding of these issues. And if it's not to be this focus on science and stuff like that, I'm interested in how, because I feel like this kind of mirrors a bit of how Extinction Rebellion is kind of pivoting and shifting at the moment in terms of the types of actions that you're taking and potentially exploring different ways of having this conversation, which, you know, leans into different faculties of the university campus. You know, like, maybe it's a little more on the creative and arts and communication and, you know, different, you know, faculties of the human experience, I suppose. So I'm interested how, you know, you guys are thinking about that stuff and kind of shifting in how we seek to kind of build a broader movement or consensus.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I've found quite challenging about the recent months in Extinction Rebellion in the UK is that, you know, there was, in some ways, we put out that message at New Year saying, like, we quit public disruption. And it got lots of attention because everybody went, oh, what a drama. They've, you know, they're going to stop doing what they do and blah, blah. How interesting. But it really set out a stall on the turf that the tabloid media want you on, which is talking about your tactics.
Right.
And I had grave concerns about doing that because we set that frame for them. And they're going to try and drag you into it anyway, right? So as a strategic messaging kind of head, I think, was that a good idea? Now, on the other hand, what it did do is it made people have a very big, very public conversation about what we were doing, which I think did really help us to be able to do this kind of coalition bridge building, inviting all of the different groups to come out with us, who are way more kind of moderate, if you like, and way more kind of part of the third sector, you know, charities, blah, blah, blah. And what I know from like comments that we've had from MPs and insiders in Westminster, for example, is that, you know, there were people in positions of power who were like, oh, shit, we didn't think they could sort of do that.
Right.
and show up with people like Friends of the Earth and CAFOD, you know, I mean, big Christian charities and stuff. So that's, you know, that is interesting. And it was a big turnout and we did get lots of people. And everyone did play nice together. And people had said to us, you know, you guys, you know, that's an absurd idea that you can be the conveners because you're the troublemakers. And it's like, yeah, but who else is going to convene everyone? Like where someone's got to do it, haven't they? Like, because there's an awful lot of us and we still don't come out in big enough numbers together, you know? So I think it's like, it's been a worthy experiment and like sort of shift to make in lots of ways. But I think now what's challenging is how to motivate people to engage in what we think is still necessary in terms of people committing to do civil disobedience and to take sort of embodied action, and to do that under these circumstances now of like basically an onset of authoritarian rule, you know, powers that have been given to the police that are fucking wild, like beyond wild, and particularly beyond wild in a circumstance where, you know, I don't know where your listenership are based, but if you're not based in the UK,
everywhere,
you might not know that the British police force, in particular the Metropolitan Police Force in London, have been found to be like endemically corrupt and systemically immensely racist, misogynist, homophobic, masses of rape cases outstanding against officers, and the, you know, the most famous one, that guy Wayne Cousins, who raped and murdered a woman after he'd not been in the force that long and was like fast-tracked into a firearms squad. So, you know, it's like there are some serious problems here. And so it's very, very remarkable that like under these conditions, the police have been given basically sort of quite a lot of scope to intrude on people's lives, to, you know, prevent people from using their freedom to express themselves. A lot of our new legislation completely clashes with ECHR, the European Charter of Human Rights. A lot of other legislation, like the stuff around refugees, also, you know, massive problems with the fact that I think the British establishment just appear to be completely disinterested in the restrictions that human rights obligations should put on you as lawmakers. And so, you know, it's a weird time because we don't know how a lot of this is going to play because it's so new. So we haven't seen many court cases go through. We haven't seen many people charged under the new laws. And you only really get to understand how they're going to get used, you know, once those cases go through. And our court system is totally fucked as well. So like it's clogged up, it's on its knees, it's not functioning well. I know people who've been on bail for more than 3 years waiting for a court case about a non-violent protest that they took part in 2020 or 2019 or whatever. So, you know, some of the cases that we're seeing going through now, there's some guys who are inside at the moment, Morgan and Marcus. They did a protest with Just Stop Oil and they suspended themselves in hammocks over this bridge, which is part of the M25, I think, in London, outside London, outskirts of London, goes around. And they were there for about 40 hours or something like that. So there was a substantial disruption, but they got remanded. They were held in prison for about 6 months. And I thought when they went into court, I thought, well, you know, they've done their time, right? Because they get a year's sentence. They'll come out if they've already served 6 months. And the judge slapped 3 years on one of them and 2 years and 7 months on the other one.
That's crazy.
And so, you know, that is what this legislation is designed to do. And the more that people see that go through the courts, obviously the more chilling the effect is going to be on people who go, well, I'm not going to get in trouble now. And I guess that's what's happening in South Australia, right? You sent me that article saying the switch from something that could get you $700 fine to a $50,000 fine or something. We've got the same stuff here. It's like you could get like charged a bit of damages and a slap on the wrist if you put a bit of paint on a statue, but now you can get like up to 10-year sentence or something. So it's like, you know, do political dissent is a much worse crime than rape in Britain today. That's what they've done.
Yeah, so looking at this case that we mentioned, I suppose the legislation that's going through in South Australia as of, this is 2 weeks ago, I think this story is from as of recording. But as you say, so fines up to $50,000 and possible 3-month jail terms where a person intentionally or recklessly obstructs the free passage of a public space. That, you know, disrupting a major road or something like that, as you're kind of referring in this other, that's just astonishing jail sentences for those guys over there. And I just, to me, it's just, again, but earlier in this conversation, we're talking about these kind of common sense and gut check things of like, well, that's not right, is it? It's clearly not right. Yeah. That's clearly an injustice. And it's like, as people look to kind of freely associate or gather or, you know, mass protest or demonstration, in if they're setting out with a kind of non-violent methodology or whatever, it feels like these jurisdictions and states are coming in and, you know, imposing these wild laws and police powers that are just straight set up to kind of clamp down on that. And as you say, have that chilling effect on people where it's like, well, then I'm playing a lottery that I might just get pulled out and slapped with years in jail. Even though it's absolutely absurd, and it's not, you know, you see this in history in sort of authoritarian or other types of states. I mean, it's textbook.
There's also a thing coming in the UK called a serious disruption prevention order, which is an injunctive order which they'll be able to put onto individuals who go and do a lot of disruptive protest. So if you've been previously... The original legislation said if you've been at a disruptive protest, then you're eligible and they could pick you out and just put it on you. So it's like you could have an injunction against you for what they deem to be a thought crime because you might be thinking about going out and doing something. So they'll put something on you to make sure that you have to stay at home. Perhaps they'll give you a curfew, restrict your travel around the country. Perhaps they want to put ankle tags on people. I mean, this is where this definitely is designed to go. And they managed to knock out like the terms that said if you've ever been at a disruptive protest, but now it's gone through, I think, on the basis that if you've ever been arrested for a protest-related case, then you know, you'll become eligible. So it really, you know, the contents of the latest legislation that's going through Britain is such that you would be shocked and calling it out if it was in Erdogan's Turkey or Putin's Russia, or, you know, you would look at other places that where you anticipate this kind of draconian approach to stifling dissent, and, you know, and you'd say this is a disgrace. But the fact that it's sort of just sliding through in Britain, and I think, you know, we obviously don't have the same global influence on every front as we perhaps once did as a nation, but we definitely still have a big political influence on the way that other people think that they should govern. And people do think that Britain is a serious democracy to, you know, pay attention to. And I, you know, it for better or for worse, we do have a global sort of audience looking at what we do here. And it's very scary to me that you know, people from all over the world are going to be looking at this and thinking, well, they've done that there, so we can do it here now as well. So I apologize to the people of Australia if our lack of ability to fight this has in some ways, you know, helped to facilitate the sort of export of the ideas, because I do think that there's ideas from the particularly the right wing think tanks that operate around Westminster that feed what I would call sort of free market fundamentalist ideological political ideas into our political system. You know, it strikes me that, I mean, obviously they're part of global networks of fuckers anyway, but it feels, you know, it feels really heartbreaking to me that we've got stuff going on in the UK that could be seen to be sort of like world leading in how to carry something, a nation that people see as a free democracy, you know, quite swiftly into the territory of authoritarian regime.
Well, I agree with what you're kind of laying out there as the UK perhaps having certainly influence globally or being a major democracy, quote unquote, that other folks would point to. I feel like in the top five of things the UK is known for as well is kind of Orwellian, you know, mass surveillance and all that kind of stuff too. I feel is synonymous with the UK. I saw George Orwell's house when I was in London last year and stuff like that. So when we have all this kind of mass surveillance and everything, and I'll say, you know, Australia has been right into that for decades now as well. So, you know, when I go to London, it really feels like I'm in Sydney. They're very similar places, to be honest.
Right.
So we don't have to pin that on you guys. Don't worry. You didn't export that particular thing. We already had our own version of it. So I'd love to turn at this point to talk about, you know, if you jump on the website and reading into, actually, maybe before I hit, sorry, I will edit this out. I would like to talk a little bit about the kind of play with the London Marathon recently. So I think that's interesting to kind of explore how that played out and lead from there into the kind of the three demands of Extinction Rebellion and talking about, you know, turning back to talking about like ending fossil fuel licenses, reparatory justice, citizens assemblies would be a nice way to kind of, yes, we've talked about how fucked it is. So here's what, this is what the kind of the proposed model would look like from the true, you know, opposition basically. So, yeah, at this point I would like to ask you about the kind of the, you know, the big one that's been playing out with XR, like in this year to date, and the kind of shift to looking to do mass mobilization as a thing. And there I've been reading up on how things were playing out around these kind of planned protests along with the London Marathon, which is this iconic London's, you know, biggest sporting event. As I'm reading, I'm learning this, apparently how big of a thing the marathon is, you know. So yeah, I'm really curious to kind of hear how that all kind of played, because there was a lot of concerns of like, oh no, they're coming to disrupt this, like this very, very important cultural sporting thing that we all do is part of the culture of London, you know? And so I found it very interesting to kind of read how you were navigating that. And in fact, being directly in touch with the London Marathon people themselves and kind of, you know, essentially, you know, relationship building well in advance, you know. But yeah, how'd that whole story play out? What was that, you know, how's your life been lately?
Well, we put a date in the diary last year for this and said, you know, like I mentioned, we'll convene. And loads of people went, you can't convene because you're a bunch of smelly hippies and no one likes you. And we said, well, we're going to try and do it. And so we started, our relationships team started like having, you know, as many meetings as they possibly could across the whole space to try and see what people would be willing to do. And, you know, the first hurdle to get people over is like, oh yeah, but you've got a bit of a tricky image because you're like naughty and that and whatever, you know. So like, we've got a conservative base with a small c. They always say that as if it's like makes it feel better. Yeah, small c conservative base that we've got that are like into the environment but they don't like you. And so we had all these sort of like funny conversations with people and basically like, you know, managed to get enough people to say, like, in theory, if it was like with, you know, permission and it wasn't illegal and we could tell everybody they weren't going to get arrested and the police had said they wouldn't nick everyone and blah, 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 then maybe, yes, we would come out and like play with you in public. And it, and then the marathon date came out whilst we had set up this big ticker on the website to build sort of momentum and show the numbers of people who'd signed up. And we didn't have loads of people on it, but it was like several thousand. And everyone went, oh, shit, the marathon's right in the middle of this whole thing. And then the coronation got like plonked on the calendar as well. And we were like, oh, shit. So we went to talk to the marathon people and just reached out to them and said, look, can we have a chat? And I went with a couple of other people to go and have an initial meeting with them. And they were super nice. And they, you know, they're sporting people. So they're sporting people, they're charity people, they're like anti-air pollution people. So, you know, they didn't want us to like dick them around or do anything tricky. But in essence, they were just up for having like a conversation about how we could potentially make it work. So we agreed to like share the streets, which I was trying to put across in interviews as like, unlike the government, we all know how to talk to each other and work out how to find a resolution to things that are difficult, right? So we agreed like our crowd would spill one way and their crowds would mostly spill the other way, because the run comes over Westminster Bridge, past the Houses of Parliament and past Parliament Square, which is where we were, you know, occupying the space. And it worked really well. And someone, basically some journalist, I don't know who started it, but somebody based on the press conference from the marathon came out and said, oh, you know, XR's guarding the marathon to protect it. And I think all this guy Hugh said, who's the director of the London Marathon, I think what he actually said was something like, you know, that we've been like working out how to collaborate to, you know, to not cause a disruption to the race or something. I don't know. But it came out in some press. You know, the press, it's like Chinese whispers. It like starts out as one thing and then it gets worse and then it gets worse and then it gets worse. And then in the end, it's like, what? Like, where did that story come from? One paper basically ended up saying something like we were going to put a ring of steel around the marathon to yeah. stop other Seriously. People from disrupting it or some shit. Like, I mean, it's just like, wow. It's like, I mean, you know, it's quite funny, isn't it? Because imagine like XR's like the mafia and we're like, hey, do you want us to protect your event? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's kind of funny, but it caused a total like drama, you know, in the press. And actually without that story, which was just made up bollocks, we would have had a lot less press, because what we did was just show up with a lot of people and do protest, which is like probably practically banned now, but wasn't quite banned then, if you know what I mean, because new regs came in like around the coronation. So, you know, days after we finished, the rules changed again. So nobody knows where they stand really with all this public order shit. But yeah, it was like the, you know, the marathon people were like perfectly nice and they just wanted to have like an honest dialogue and find a resolution. And we did. And because that's a nice story, it's like not a good news story. So they made up loads of shitty news stories instead. And at our press conference, we were saying like, they said, oh, are you going to disrupt the marathon? The Daily Mail, which is like one of the most toxic, like shit rag newspapers in Britain. The Daily Mail person was there going, but are you going to disrupt the marathon, the coronation? And we said no. And then at the end of the press conference, they're fucking in the Zoom chat asking us again, because basically it wasn't the answer they wanted. So then they go off and just fabricate a story about us disrupting the coronation, even though we told them we weren't going to and nobody was planning to, and we didn't. And no one even tried to do it. So, you know, but they, all of the run up to it was speculation, fears from organizers that maybe, you know, protesters are going to do something. We can't disclose what because there's no evidence for it, but everyone's really frightened. It's an atmosphere of dread and fear, you know, because these non-violent people might do something that's peaceful but annoying, and everyone's really fucking frightened. Ah, you know, they do that, like it just whips it up. And in a way, it's sort of, you know, it gets you some attention, but it's just, it's getting to the point where it's sort of embarrassing, you know, like I feel like the media is embarrassing itself because it's run out of road, you know, like, so it just has to make, they just have to make shit up. Anyway, we did that and the marathon happened and it was all fine and we were all friends and, you know, isn't that nice? And obviously in some ways that illustrated to ourselves, like the scale of cooperation that's possible and all of that kind of stuff. But what it also helped, I think, to illustrate to the sort of what I would term the moderates is that if you behave like that, nobody pays you very much attention. So they pay you attention if they're like spouting made up bile and shit, but they won't pay you any attention for what you're actually doing or what you're actually trying to talk about, because we didn't get that much traction really, you know, in terms of the media. So it was hard trying to get the message through.
Talking about how the media will just spout absolute nonsense and something that may have touched the zeitgeist a little bit, I think during lockdown times, was the Don't Look Up film and Adam McKay and stuff like that. And yeah, kind of spelling it out in a filmic context of like just the absurdity of what media will just throw and not wanting to platform these supposedly dangerous ideas and, you know, filling a lot of column inches with, well, we don't know what's happening, but we're going to speculate wildly and everyone's really terrified. But also being very concerned about, well, we don't want to actually platform their ideas or what they're seeking to come and ask for. And you're saying, so, this is news to me that you're kind of saying that you feel like you guys didn't get as much kind of reach or impact or in communicating of the thing. And for folks listening, curious to kind of delve into, you know, these three demands of Extinction Rebellion that you can read about, to end all new fossil fuel licenses, approvals and funding for fossil fuel projects, for reparatory justice and citizens assemblies. And like, if you kind of get past the first little, you know, the first little jumps and hurdles and things to read of like, what is Extinction Rebellion about? Actually, I appreciate that when you actually jump on the website, the demands are like quite reasonable and upfront. And we're talking about the kind of autocratic nightmare situation along with the kind of the climate emergency that, you know, we're kind of recognizing. And, you know, Extinction Rebellion is not here just to make noise and be mad about the situation. Like, you actually have some pretty compelling ideas of alternatives of how things can actually be done differently. Like, it's one thing to make a lot of noise, but it's a different thing to actually have some actual ideas, which I think XR does.
Yeah, I mean, on Don't Look Up, I'll just say that, you know, when I watched that film, I burst into tears afterwards because I've been that person in that studio with somebody saying really inane stuff and myself feeling just the emotional drain on me as an individual, you know, trying to bring my entire like heart and soul into this work because of the gravity of the situation, and to be met with just like a load of sort of puerile chat is, I find it personally quite hard work emotionally, like in terms of emotional labor. I would recommend, by the way, that people listen to Roger Hallam's podcast about designing the revolution that he's been doing recently. And I just listened to one the other day where he's talking about media interviews, and it's quite helpful reframing of the scenario, because I think, God, you know, why can't we get the truth out through media spaces? And his sort of challenge to that is like it's a game. So when you go into the chat show space or the newsroom, it's entertainment. It's not about the truth, and it's not about helping people understand the world. It's about entertainment. And with that, it's like a game of wits. So when you walk into that room, you're not faced with a person who's doing a journalistic job with integrity, trying to get to the truth. You're faced with a person who is perhaps trying to do that a bit, but not nearly as much as they're trying to like win a game of wits against you as an individual contributor. And that reframing of the entire dynamic, I thought was quite helpful for me as a spokesperson, because it's, you know, it helps me to sort of, I guess, kind of reframe the context that I'm walking into before I go into it. Otherwise, I just walk out heartbroken and screaming and start crying and stuff. But the demands from XR have been like massively overlooked, I think. And one of the things that we definitely did quite well with at the start was that we came out and said we want net zero 2025. And that was much sooner than anyone else was saying. And so a lot of people who've, you know, involved in the political world have said to me over the last few years, you know, your 2025 message helped drag everybody nearer to it. So now you have people who talk about 2030. And I think we helped to influence that sort of part of the debate, if you like, because the main territory was 2050. And the main question in the sort of third sector, as I was aware of it in 2019, was people saying, oh, should we say 2040 or 2045? You know, like we go a bit sooner than the state. So for us to be in the mix going 2025, 2025, it helped haul that Overton window, you know, into a different place. And I think that was valuable, and it has helped. But the rest of our demands, and particularly the third demand for a citizens assembly approach to political decision making, just has been totally overlooked by most people. And when you spend 20 minutes talking to somebody about what deliberative democracy is, they'll go, that sounds quite sensible, you know. And increasingly, the researchers putting suggestions into the IPCC reports and across the spectrum of the climate sort of expert discussion space, people are saying, well, you have to have deliberative processes with citizens because you need big buy-in, because you need to like really turn around a lot of shit in society in a way that has never happened before, at that speed that's needed and at the scale that's needed and the impact on people's lives that's going to have. You have to do stuff with direct dialogue with the public and buy-in from across the political spectrum, because otherwise people are going to resist it. And if you resist taking action on climate, obviously you're resisting something that's hopefully seeking to preserve life. And so if people are sort of resisting something that's life-saving because they don't like the smell of it politically, well, you need to have a conversation about it and do it like grown-ups, not let it be mediated through the media. And also, you need to have a far more sort of rigorous discussion than you can have in parliamentary debate. You know, deliberation isn't debate, it's different. It's about sitting down with loads of information and really discussing what's good and what's bad and the pros and the cons. At the moment in Britain and probably lots of other places, you know, our political system is based on combative debating tactics, which are, you know, often at the expense of any nuance or detail. They force people to fight in binary ways about things that are far more complex than that. They debase the conversation, in my opinion, to something which is like not which is not doing justice to the complex and, you know, existential reality of what we're trying to deal with. And at the same time, you know, because the culture war and the mainstream press and the politicians in Britain are really taking part in this culture war shit, there's such a stoking of division that, you know, people need, I think, a route to political decision making that can show not only like pro-social outcomes are possible and mature and difficult conversations are possible to be had, but also, you know, that people who think that they don't agree or don't like each other are capable of sitting down and saying what's best for our children and then deciding something together. And, you know, because of the scale of what's needed, if you don't have like a lot of engagement across the board, then it's going to be very easy to derail the things that come out of these processes. And I think we very much need to look at alternative ways of decision making, because until we change the people and the systems that we're using to make decisions, I think it's quite clear that we're not going to make different decisions politically. And if we can't make different decisions, then we're totally monumentally fucked forever. Because something's got to change, and at the moment nothing's changing. In fact, like it's being made worse. And you know, in XR we used to say the government doesn't have a plan, but actually, you know, they do have a plan brewing, and it's mostly to do with flights to Rwanda for refugees, it's mostly to do with tightening borders, it's mostly to do with suffocating dissent, it's mostly to do with shutting everything down and desperately clinging to you know, to a sort of form of state overreach that enables you to secure public order for a bit longer whilst people can't afford to feed themselves, pay their bills, they're petrified about the climate crisis, which is like happening, unfolding now, probably going to cause massive food price spikes in the coming years. And so people are just going to be terrorized, I think, by the scenario. And if you can create an alternative way of doing politics, which is essentially socially soothing and mature and compassionate and about listening and about compromise and about trusting each other, you know, that's all the things that if you put any of those words into a conversation about British politics, people just laugh at you, because there's no room for trust, there's no compassion, there's no care, there's no freedom, there's no love. You know, it sounds like an absurd proposition, but we're so fucked that I think you can only make an absurd proposition in terms of having a reasonable proposition. It has to seem absurd from the position we're in, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think the political situation you're describing essentially resonates with, you know, going in and interacting with the media as well. It's gamesmanship and debate and playing for time. All these things is play for time. We just grind it out and another parliamentary session is over and whatever, and it just kind of spirals around. So I find this kind of aspiration to citizen assemblies and different forms of process like very interesting. And I imagine that there's experiments going on with that and what that may look like. But I'm also curious to talk about another demand from Extinction Rebellion for reparatory justice, which I feel is such a key thing to touch on, at least briefly in this conversation. If someone hasn't heard that term before, like, what is this whole topic about?
Yeah. Well, first thing to say is that there are experts on reparatory justice who you can go and look up, and
we could link in the show notes.
I'll give you some links for things that you can look up. And there's somebody who's been part of our community, of our movement for a long time, Esther, who's an expert on reparatory justice and did a lecture for us. So I'll send that link to you. You know, I think a lot of people think that reparations are only about paying people. And the concept of reparatory justice, as I understand it, as I have been had it explained to me by people, is that it's, you know, far more, it needs to be far more holistic in its approach. If you're going to heal or repair a situation which has involved, you know, total atrocity, then there are many layers of repair to be done. And that might include repairing people's sense of themselves, people repairing themselves, people repairing their relationships to one another. Restore, you know, you also hear this term restorative justice. There's a lot of different approaches to the idea of justice itself. And the idea of being able to try and repair what's taken place, obviously, when you look at something on the scale of imperialism, colonialism, and the damage and the length of time that damage has been, you know, it taking place, allowed to occur, you know, it is an immense sort of multi-generational traumatic occurrence. And so if you are going to seek to restore or repair anything to do with that, it's like, it's really complicated because it's immense. And you know, aside from the I hope obvious things that you can draw that show the connection between, you know, colonialism and the climate crisis, extractivism, the plunder and abuse of the global south by the global north, the immense kind of example of globalized racism that you can see in the climate story. You know, if you're going to seek justice in these circumstances, it's not as simple as making a category called loss and damage, which then wealthy countries seek to use as a way of saying, well, we'll just destroy your nation, but we'll pay you off. By the way, we're also going to like board up the borders and we're not going to let you in. So we'll like, I mean, I don't know what this all means, because it's like, we're going to pay you off, but we're also going to block you from coming to seek safety. None of it makes any sense once you sort of engage with the dialogue, I don't think, that's taking place on a national level, because it's insane if you're going to like make, you know, a massive amount of the world uninhabitable. You can't pay people off for that. Like, that's loss and damage doesn't cut it, right? If you're going to obliterate people's homes, or if you're going to put their islands underwater so they basically don't exist, like, you can't pay, how do you pay someone off for that? It's a joke, you know. It's not a loss and damage situation. That's like an annihilation. It's a different thing. but we don't have the right language, I don't think, because when you talk to legal experts, you know, genocide is something quite specific. And annihilation of certain people through climate doesn't technically fit that legal framework. And I don't think that we understand really quite how to articulate still in a sense of, you know, human rights or international law, like what is actually taking place. Because of the enormity of it. But if you were going to take an approach to climate justice that didn't seek to just pay people for things that have gone wrong, which, by the way, we've agreed to pay some people some stuff and we don't pay it anyway, so the payments don't move, But even if we were doing that, there's a deeper approach, basically, which is more interested in a holistic approach to repair and restoration and healing between people. And that is a, I guess, sort of, you know, having that statement as part of what XR's saying is the route that we would advocate for in dealing with this situation, that then needs an awful lot of exploration with people who do come from more affected places in the world to engage in sort of depth. What does that look like? And what does that mean? I think one of the things that we're conscious of is that, you know, what XR did with that 2025 date, for example, is, you know, I said we sort of managed to, we helped to move the Overton window. And for me, there's a conversation that goes on about climate justice, which I think could be enriched by a discussion about what reparatory and restorative approaches to justice might look like. And my friend Nick, who's a scholar, helps me like think about this stuff. And he said to me, "Claire, you have to understand the word justice, you know, it's a thing that's like clumsy, cumbersome, it's massive. It's like, what is it? Like, what the fuck is justice? People go around shouting justice, justice, justice. But I've really learned over the years that like, that's not a simple word to go around shouting. And, you know, we, putting the word reparatory next to it, for some people sounds a bit complicated because they go, well, what's that? But if you sit with them for a minute and ask them if they really know what justice means anyway, they probably also don't know what that word means. so it's worth expanding on what you mean by justice. And at the same time, you know, I think there's been something missing from the climate movement that I know more people are becoming interested in, which is a different kind of justice, which is about accountability, right? Because like this, there are people who've like made this situation happen on purpose and they're rich because of it. And our movements have not centered on, you know, printing their faces on posters and shoving them in the street on placards and saying, you know, this is Bernard Looney, he's an evil man, or whatever. We've not done that. But you look at what's coming through the Yellow Dot Studios work from Adam McKay, and I think we'll increasingly see, alongside like real life litigation cases from a lot of youth like plaintiffs, I think you are also going to see a big movement to say, actually, some of the most culpable people in this situation, you know, they've got a face and a name and an address, and people are going to start talking about justice in that way too, which is you know, well, who knows where that goes, right? I find it a little bit intense to imagine what the younger generation will unleash on some of these people if they don't die out before the youth take control of the justice system and the state or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, but yeah.
So as XR, the, you know, one of the three demands is kind of end all new fossil fuel licenses, like address this fact that huge corporate interests and banks and whatnot can like invest in new fossil fuel ventures everywhere. I live in Australia. It's happening everywhere all the time. I thought you may be a good person to ask about the kind of the current state of play for the climate as of now. You alluded to it earlier about like, guess what? Like the impacts and the effects seem to be coming sooner than expected. They're more monumental than were predicted by models or whatnot. So I suppose for folks listening, for a little kind of energy surge and a motivation at the end of this thing, like maybe there are a few things that we can kind of point towards in terms of like, well, here's some findings that we've seen this year, and this is fucking insane, and this is happening, perhaps. And we can certainly share materials in the blog post as well.
Yeah, sure. So there's a few things. This isn't news, but, you know, the polar regions are warming much faster than the rest of the world, which is bad because, in a simplistic way, the very cold areas being at two opposite ends of the planet help to keep global weather patterns moving in sort of regular ways that we can broadly predict. So there is a grave concern that the destabilization of those regions, and potentially that the tipping points are already being triggered, from which there's no return, where you're guaranteed to lose all of the ice eventually, you know, that then weather systems become extremely destabilized by those. And we've got an El Nino year happening now, which is going to mean that it's hot. And we've had a few years of, my understanding is we've had a few years of general cooling because of the conditions. And what's it called? The opposite of El Nino is Niña or something. But
yeah,
basically, Niña. We've had a few cooler years. Now we're going into some hotter years. You know, last year was horribly hot anyway in Britain, and you know, frightened a lot of people with all the fires and stuff. So I think this year, you know, things are going to continue to be clearly worse than they were originally predicted to be around this time. And people are going to carry on saying, oh, it's worse than we thought, and it's faster than expected, and all of this. But at the same time, you know, we've got people talking about stuff which needs airing, about things like the aerosol cooling effect of pollution. So basically, when you pollute using like heavy shipping fuel, which has been just cleaned up a little bit by some regulation, which is making the climate worse by using cleaner fuel, then you have quite a challenging conversation that you need to have with the public, which is, yes, you know, air pollution is making the world hotter, but the particulate pollution is making the world slightly cooler. And scientists haven't been talking about it in detail because, well, I think partly because they can't really be certain about the amount of cooling that is the impact. And, you know, as scientists, they don't want to talk about things if they can't be accurate. So then sometimes they just leave them out, which is frightening as fuck, in my opinion. So there's very little conversation that's been happening about this in the mainstream climate discourse. People have got a sort of dominant narrative that says carbon's a thermostat. You turn it down, you turn down the temperature. That's not how it works anyway. It's far more complicated than that. But also, when you turn it down, you lose the air pollution, which is having this cooling impact overall. So you actually, when you reduce air pollution, it gets hotter quicker for a bit. Not ongoing, because once it's gone, it's gone. But it makes it hot. It makes it worse. And to be able to tell people that, you know, when we grounded planes during lockdowns and COVID, and when people stopped driving around the cities, the surface area of those cities went up massively. That's quite a challenging conversation to have with a public who have only just really been brought on board to agree that it's definitely happening, and it's definitely carbon, and it's definitely us, and it's definitely going to fuck you. But also, now we're going to go, but there's this sort of paradoxical thing as well, which you need to understand, like particulate pollution. And all of that, imagine trying to have that conversation moderated by a scientifically illiterate and willfully ignorant and politically bought mainstream press. And you think, well, we are fucked, really, because that's a really difficult conversation to have, you know. But it's one that we need to have, because it could be that that's having a massive impact. And some people think, you know, that could be like half a degree.
That's
so
crazy.
When people go, every fraction of a degree matters, and then they're like, oh yeah, there's this like half a degree that might be attached to these pollutants. And you know, what's also important to note is that these pollutants have a life expectancy in the atmosphere of like days, whereas carbon dioxide lasts for decades in its heating effect. But if you stop driving cars around a city, the pollution disappears in less than a week, most of it. So the cooling forcing aspect is very, very short lived compared with the heating forcing aspect of pollution, which is long, super long term. And then on top of that, there's also, I think, probably some, and obviously I'm not a proper scientist, right? I was into science, but I'm also a fashion designer. I'm not a science expert. So you have to look up this stuff to find your best experts to listen to on it. But my understanding is that there's also, you know, water vapor is a very, very potent greenhouse gas, and there's a lot of it. And the hotter the world gets, there will be a bit more of it. And so for everything that you heat the world, you've also got changes going on with the hydrological cycle, changes happening to cloud cover, which also affects heating and cooling, and then changes to the amount of water vapor that's in the Earth's atmosphere. And that is also not really talked about very much in the mainstream climate discourse. So I'm going to try in the coming months to sort of find the right experts to talk to about this stuff and think about ways that we can try and have some of these conversations in detail, because they're not simple things to discuss, which is why I think they get left off the table quite often. And see if you know, there's some useful conversations that can be had to help us sort of grasp the nuance and the complexity of some of this stuff as we move into you know, the future of our sort of climate movement communications work, you know, because it strikes me as hugely problematic if people are being sort of brought on a journey to believe that, you know, carbon is a sort of thermostat story and we can turn it down. And it's it's contentious in scientific community, so I'll probably get told off for this conversation, but effectively it's not as simple as carbon emissions being a dial that you turn up and down.
Something that I'm curious to ask quickly is, like, so if XR has this 2025 net zero kind of target that you're communicating, and I'm curious to explore, is no doubt you're having a lot of conversations with a lot of people, reading broadly, you're aware of many things. And is this a notion of, like, we need to achieve something like that because we all need to, you know, achieve that so we can sort of buy a moment or buy time or kind of pull stuff back to unknown miracle scientific discovery that's going to help kind of start turning, as we discover technologies into the future that can kind of start to repair, restore the natural world or deal with, like, you know, these particles in the atmosphere in complex ways that maybe we don't understand as of now. I'm curious about, you know, is it about, you know, achieving these targets so that we can have the space and the opportunity to deal with things like that? Or is that the wrong way to kind of frame this, that there isn't this kind of, you know, golden technological solution that's in our future, and for in this moment right now, it's just about, let's get this shit a little under control and be a little responsible about stuff so that we can navigate this thing into the future. Am I reading that correctly? Because, you know, like, do you hear from folks about, like, well, we think if we do this, this can, like, you know, transform the planet in these ways, and we can, what do you call that when they talk about geoforming Mars or something like
geoengineering.
That? Geoengineering, this kinds of thing. So I'm curious about, like, is this even present in the conversation about how we think about an optimist sort of, what do we call it? Like a solar punk kind of future of a world in which suddenly all the cities are draped in forest and we're growing crops in the center of a, you know, and all this kind of, like, we've turned into this utopian environmental kind of world. Who even knows what question I'm asking right now? I should apologize. So I was trying to kind of map this place between A and B about, like, I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about technological wondrous solutions to this thing in the near future. Is that even something that, you know, people should have in mind, or is just right now we just need to get shit in order and get towards these targets so we can have a sensible conversation in a decade or two from now, you know?
Well, I think it's appropriate because if you want to be having any conversation in a decade or two, we need to stop the fossil fuel industry from being able to carry on like a juggernaut with no means of anyone being able to restrict any of its activities, which is what the situation is right now. And to be honest, I can't see personally, like, I can't see a way that's effective and direct to do that right now, right? So we're systemically quite trapped in our circumstances, I think, particularly when you look at like major players like Russia, Saudi Arabia, you know, that there are nations who are involved in this, nation states, there are private companies, it's complicated. Some of these countries will look like they will never want to, you know, leave any of their reserves in the ground. Probably the same is true for the United States. Probably the same is true for the UK, right? We're issuing fucking 100 licenses right now. So that's a big problem. And I think because we are so committed to the re-engineering of the Earth's systems, which we've already been doing. So I think James Hansen has recently framed it like this, and I think it's very valuable, that we have engaged in a process of geoengineering already. It's called creating the climate crisis. And it's, you know, burning all of the fossil reserves that were in the ground and putting all of the carbon in the sky is a form of geoengineering. Deforestation at the scale that we've done it all over the world is a form of geoengineering.
Absolutely.
Like forever chemicals that are undermining, that are helping to undermine plankton life in the ocean. If that problem is as bad as some people reckon it could be, then, you know, that's also could be seen as undermining life in our oceans is a form of geoengineering. So we're already doing that. So I think it's, you know, there are people like Sir David King and other experts who are looking at this as like, we need to engage in earth cooling approaches. And for that, you know, you need a different sort of intellectual view. So James Hansen's got a new paper about global warming, like in the pipeline. And it's basically like trying to ascertain what's coming and over what time frame and what is the scale. And a lot of people have said, well, this can be forcing, you know, temperatures within this century up to as much as X, you know, and the conversation ranges anything from 2 and a bit degrees by people who are fucking optimistic, in my opinion, to as far as sort of 5 or 6 or something. And so his recent paper has been gone out for review and people have been saying, is it as far as 10 degrees and over what time frame? And maybe that could be like over much more. It's not by the end of this century, but, you know, beyond. I don't know. There was an update on it the other day that I've not completely read yet. But what's useful to think about is that the framing of it is about the Earth's energy imbalance. So it's not about carbon emissions. I think the climate conversation, often people just, it's very reductive and people talk about carbon. And if you're lucky, they talk about methane and carbon dioxide. But if you're unlucky, it's even more reductive and it's only about carbon dioxide, right? So it's like carbon, carbon, carbon. But actually, the thing that's giving us shit isn't the carbon, it's the heat. It's the energy that's trapped that's giving us, like, you know, wild and dangerous weather patterns and extreme weather events and ruining crops. And, I do this talk. I meant to mention this earlier. I do these talks sometimes and use pictures of what's happening around the world to sort of situate ourselves in sort of like what's happening now. And one of the pictures is from Australia, and it's I always use it to sort of illustrate the absurdity of how severe this situation is going to get, because it's some poor fucker whose house is like flooded up to the beyond the first floor, and the roof's on fire as well. So it's like, you know, but anyway, the extreme things that are happening like that, you know, they're really because of the energy that's trapped. And obviously the energy's being trapped by what's happening, but it's not the carbon atoms themselves that are hurting your home, right? It's the heat. So if you look at it in that way, then you can start to say, well, is there an urgent process under which we could try to cool the earth down, try and get the energy out, or try and stop the energy coming in, right? And then people go, oh shit, you're going to start talking about geoengineering, and that's super scary, because a lot of people advocate for things like spraying sulfur or sulfates, I can't remember, into the atmosphere. So you're basically putting stuff into the upper atmosphere that blocks sunlight and stops the heat from coming in, and that can have lots of like unintended negative consequences, and we don't know what will happen. It feels like it's super high risk, but there are other means of trying to intervene that, as I understand it, are less there's less potential unintended consequence. They're more benign, or they're more reversible, basically. And so the people I've been talking to are interested in exploring the ways that you can do this that are the most reversible, basically, or the most benign. And one proposed project, which I think is interesting for various reasons, is called the MIRS project. And that's like about putting mirrors out to reflect the sun back into space. So you basically replace the albedo effect of like the polar regions being white, they reflect a lot of heat straight out of the Earth's atmosphere. You can replace some of that with mirrored surface. And actually what's interesting about this project is that the guy behind it is looking at how you can put projects into very hot areas where you can basically cool the sort of heat island effect. So he's just put an experimental project out in, I think, in Sierra Leone. Where you basically cover like the roofs of buildings with mirrors. And then obviously the buildings themselves cool down and the area cools down. And they've been doing lots of tests with it. And I think it's an interesting area for exploration. And there's a few other things around that you can look at. Some people are advocating for marine cloud brightening. You basically get seawater and carry it in a plane and spray it into the atmosphere to form cloud cover. And some people think that you could do that above the Arctic, for example, to shield it a bit more from the sunlight and maybe protect it so it melts less quickly, and where you might be able to just slow down the breakdown of the Arctic region by helping it to be more consistently covered with clouds. And again, that's, you know, you're making clouds, and then I presume that they'll just rain down at some point, move around. It's an intervention. I'm not an expert in it. I think it's quite complex, sort of like how these things can play out. But there's a whole suite of stuff that people are suggesting. And some of them, you know, some of them do sound frightening. And I also think that, I don't know if you've read Ministry for the Future, Kim Stanley Robinson's book, but it's a kind of climate fiction book. And in that book, you know, nations that are suffering, like India, basically decide to just employ modes of geoengineering without international agreement, you know.
Right.
And they do it out of desperation. And I do think that that's a viable political future for us, that people will just decide to engage with these approaches without talking to anyone else or making a proper agreement. And if you think that, like, international agreements were made basically that we're going to definitely fuck you and your country, and they were the only ones that anyone would sign from the global north, then eventually you're going to see that as like an act of war or something, aren't you? Because people have intentionally destroyed you and your nation and your community and everything. And so you'll think, well, fuck you, we'll do this if we think it's going to cool us down for a few months. And to hell with everyone else. Like, because some of the techniques, I think, can, you know, damage rainfall for neighboring countries. You know, people are very worried about water wars that are going to break out, because yeah, if one nation has the sort of upstream control of a diminishing water supply from glacier melt, they're not, you know, they're going to cut it off, aren't they? And then you're going to be at war with each other because you've got no water. Well, I think, you know, similarly, people are going to start to engage in these things if we're not careful. So we need a far more sort of mature global discussion about what geoengineering means and what can be done and how safe it is. And people need to be brought on along this journey of having this conversation, I think, ASAP, because people are going to become quite desperate quite more quickly than we think, I expect. And the more people have explored the issues, then the better, because it's fucking complicated, basically.
Well, this conversation has inspired me to kind of delve back into that area a little bit more. Kind of fascinating to hear about, you know, that there are ideas, some of them wild ideas, for things that can be done, and then it immediately comes back to difficult political situations playing out in a futurist landscape in coming decades and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, this world is complicated, for sure. I want to express great thanks for you, like, taking the time to come and sit and record with us in your UK morning time. And curious to ask for folks listening who, you know, are interested to go, we'll have stuff like in the show notes, in the blog post, there'll be extra stuff to kind of delve into. But, you know, if someone is curious about Extinction Rebellion, things like this, where should they go online to kind of get up to speed and potentially get involved?
The best place to go, if you're international, is probably the rebellion.global website, where there's a map and you'll be able to see on there whether you've got a local, whether you've got a national organizing group in your country. And if you do, then you'll probably have local chapters in different parts of the country. It's a very decentralized structure in terms of the global reach. I would also say that if you're interested in, you know, the more full-on sort of non-violent direct action work that is taking place in the climate movement with groups like Just Stop Oil and Last Generation in Germany, there's a network where they're connected up called the A22 network, and you could look that up. And they are, well, there's people in Sweden, there's people in Canada, there's people in, I think, Italy, there may be a group in Australia, but there's lots and lots of people organizing around kind of sustained mass kind of non-violent direct action through those groups as well. So yeah, you've got lots to choose from, basically.
Thank you again to Claire for coming on UFO. You can find her on Twitter at Claire Totti. Links to her socials and projects are in the show notes at ufo.mirror.xyz. Thanks to our sponsors who made this episode possible. To get started with Zerion and create your new crypto wallet, head to zerion.io. For the best of Web3 in one feed, visit yup.io. To join the Lens ecosystem and explore the future of Web3 social, head to lens.xyz. Subscribers can collect our NFTs at ufoclub.lens. This is Nick Hollins, signing off from UFO.